Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
Hey, this is YD from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a goat?
History's strange, it's alien, and it won't give us what we would like to have. If you hear a historical story, and at the end you feel thoroughly satisfied by it, and find that it perfectly coincides with your own political inclinations, it probably means that you're actually listening to ideology or mythology.
I would love to be able to regulate the content of speech. The First Amendment prevents me from doing so. And that's simply a function of the First Amendment, but I think over the long run, it's better that government does not regulate the content of speech. I would urge these private sector companies to regulate it better themselves, but it's really nothing that I believe government can do, and so that's been my position all along.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, baby!
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life. Thought about the laws of gravity, history, that First Amendment thingy, freedom to be a jerk, orcas, Apollo, politics, and or the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. I am still struggling to process this History is Dying article from a couple of weeks ago in the Smithsonian Magazine. And I'm wondering now, am I part of the problem? My old nemesis, Ted Lieu, is in the news again for being Ted Lieu. Who's surprised? Governor Inslee wants a lot, and I mean a lot, of new money and taxes to save the orcas. If you're a mentally ill person, how do you feel about that? And it was this day in 1972 that we humans did something for the very last time. And I'm not necessarily sure that we'll ever do it again. I mean, I think we will, but certainly don't seem to be headed that way. Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine, area code 209-565-DAVE. The email, dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on the web. Just look for us on Facebook and Twitter. Look for The Dave Bowman Show on iTunes. Well, is at thedavebowmanshow.com or podcast99.org. Ego BRB Capulus ut ale viveri. I drink coffee that others might live. Well, it's like the final show of 2018, the final regular show. We are going to do Constitution Thursday next Thursday because there's something that I want to wrap up. But for regular shows, this is it for 2018. It's been an interesting year. It's been a fun year, and it's been a challenging year at times, and it's ending on a good note, I think. I think we're headed in a good direction with this, and then I'm enjoying myself again, and I'm happy. So that being said, it's the end of the year, and I got a lot of stuff, you know, popping up. And oddly enough, Ben is in school next week, and so I really toyed with the idea of going ahead and doing shows through next week, but then to take 2 weeks off, I don't get back until the 6th, and I didn't like that. I'd rather be back on the 2nd when Ben is still out of school. But it's possible that some family event will come up there, but we're going to plan for that. We're going to plan that this is the final regular show. We will have a Constitution Thursday next Thursday, but other than that, I'm going to take my Christmas vacation, my holiday vacation. Which is kind of a weird thing to say because I don't really do anything but this. So it's like, well, you know, how do you take a vacation when you don't really do anything? But it'll be a good time to just kind of relax a little bit and to spend some time with Cammy when she's not working and with Ben when he's out of school. And I'm looking forward to that over the next couple of weeks. So there is that. I am really having a hard time. I know this sounds weird, but that article couple of weeks ago. The show was November 30th, so I read the article before that. But the article was in Smithsonian Magazine about why history majors are dying off. Why, not dying off, but nobody's taking history in college anymore. The history majors are down something like 35% over the last 5 years or some number like that. And there's a lot of concern about this. Well, what does this mean? What does this say? And what is this doing? And I, you know, at the time we talked about it and we talked about, you know, what is history? What's happening to history? Why is this happening? What's going on here? And it's kind of a personal thing to me. And I'm having a hard time. The more research I do on this, sorry for banging the microphone around there a little bit. The more research I do on this, the more I'm becoming concerned about it. I know it seems odd, but it's true. Further research has showed, as I suspected that day, that all the humanities disciplines were down, and in fact they are, but none like history. None have crashed like history. And when it comes to even within the history disciplines, if you're talking about, I don't know, military history, societal history, you know, whatever, political history is the only one that is kind of growing, and it's not even growing at all. I mean, it's just not dying as fast as the other ones, and the other ones are like, it's kind of weird. There's nobody studying diplomacy, the history of diplomacy. Nobody's studying military history, and it's kind of strange for me to feel that way, because I feel like I know literally a million people who are into that. People every day tell me, oh, I love history. But do they? I'm not sure. And it kind of becomes a bit of a problematic for me, because I'm not a professional historian in the sense that I get paid for my history work. I did not go to college to study history. Although, as I've said on numerous occasions, I'd love to get my degree in history. I'm just not going to pay some college tens of thousands of dollars to give me a piece of paper that says you officially know what you already know. I just don't see the value in that. I really don't. It doesn't change what I know. It doesn't change how I feel. It doesn't change who I am. I think that the college industry has become something of something of a cattle industry. You know, just give us money. We'll give you a piece of paper. That doesn't necessarily prove that you know anything or you did anything. And I'm not saying college is easy. I'm not saying college is a waste of time. What I'm saying is it's very expensive. And I'm not sure that the ROI on that is worth it. Of course, nobody's studying that because they don't study any history. So they don't understand those things, I guess, in the big scheme of things. But I know so many people who are historians who love history, who use it every day. I in high school, I've told you this, is when my love for history started with Mr. Miller. And then the following year, my folks moved to Utah, which was culture shock. Let me assure you, that was an event. And I was actually talking with a good friend of mine last night about that from all those years ago. And she was expressing that same thought. You know, I don't know. She was like, well, I don't know how you handled that. I mean, that would have been culture shock for me. And it was culture shock for me. So at any rate, it was there that I met my high school best friends, Lee, Mike, and Mick. And we studied history. We played war games, Avalon Hill war games. I don't know if you know those or not, but we played those every Tuesday and Saturday night for usually about 6-8 hours. It was not unusual for me to get home 2-3 in the morning. And then my parents later on normally would have objected to that. They never did. And my dad put it fairly succinctly years later. Well, we knew where you were, so it wasn't a big deal. We played these games, and we played games that covered history from Alexander the Great all the way to and through World War II. And we learned our history that way. And we would read the designer's notes of the game, and then we would come up with some weird mechanical thing in the game that we either didn't understand or didn't like or something along those lines. And so we would go and research it in history, and we would spend hours in the libraries and buying books and that sort of thing. And I look back at it now, and it was not a disciplined study of history. We didn't sit down and go, okay, we are going to learn the 17 most important things about World War I, or, you know, the Spanish Inquisition or whatever. But we did learn all of that stuff. And we did absorb it. And we took those lessons from that and we applied them not just to what we were doing, but to our lives as well. What a fascinating way to learn history. What a fascinating way to learn something. But we're not doing that as a society anymore. We're not doing that. And it's becoming apparent that there is clearly something that is not right. Something is not working here if we're ignoring the historical disciplines. I suspect, and this is my own thought process, and again, I've been thinking about this for 2 weeks. I know it's probably not all that important to you. I know, man, somebody went to jail. Cohen went to jail. Trump knew. I know. Every conservative chat show host in the country is screaming his head off about that today. I'm sorry. That's not who I am. Yes, I'm a conservative chat show host. But that doesn't interest me because I recognize it for the kabuki theater that it is. And that's all it is. It's just kabuki theater. If you think that this was a act of justice, clearly you have not been studying history. I think that there are two cultural touchstones here that are impacting this across the board. Number one is the general, across the board general discrediting of history. Now, there are some reasons for that, and there are some legitimate reasons for that. Number one, history as a discipline, as a functional thing in our educational process, has been pretty bland for way too long. Oh, I know, there's a lot of exciting things in history, and there's things that we can talk about. But from a general rule of thumb, I mean, even in my case, I'm looking at the books on my shelf. This is true. They ignored, well into the 1960s, they ignored history that didn't seem to fit the political agenda of the day. It wasn't that they just erased it. They just didn't talk about it. They didn't talk about things that were uncomfortable and made people oogie a little bit. And the truth of the matter is that if you're going to really study history, you have to study those things. You have to talk about those things. You have to talk about slavery. You have to talk about the idea of the Confederacy was about slavery, not about states' rights. You have to talk about those things. You have to get into the evils of mankind. Because if you don't, then you're just sort of, pardon the phrase, whitewashing it. And you're not really paying attention to it. And because history did that, and I'm using the generic term history, did that for so long, there's a tendency now that we are more, what's the phrase, woke, to look at that history and go, well, it doesn't apply to me, so I don't really care. That's our own fault. It's our own fault for downplaying that, and I don't mean me personally, because I didn't write these books on the shelves, but the people who went through those things that thought that they were important, that then decided that they weren't important enough for everybody. I think that's the first one, that cultural touchstone of the fact that it tends to not cover everything. That's the first one. The second one is the Satiana, what I call Satianus Maxim. Remember this? We talked about it. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. We have so, as historians, we have so misapplied this statement, this quote, this maxim, if you will, from Satiana. We have used that like a mouse in a cartoon uses a frying pan to brain a cat that's chasing him. We have taken that statement. We have taken that idea to be ipso facto the determining factor about whether or not a history is important or not. We have taken that to the point where if you don't know everything about, you know, Panamania monetary policy in the 1700s, there wasn't any, so I'm just making that up, then clearly you are not qualified to have a conversation with me about things that really are important. We have used that maxim in such a way as to be, I don't know. The thing I don't like about that maxim is if you take that maxim to its logical conclusion, it's ultimate interpretation. If you don't remember the past, you're doomed to repeat it. How did we ever learn to fly? Did the first airplane get off the ground the first time? Oh my gosh, we better remember our history that man isn't meant to fly and not try again. Ooh. Did we not remember that man can't go into space? Well, then how did we make it to the moon? If we remembered the history, the interpretation of that, though, has become this, like I said, it's become a cast iron skillet to whack people who all of a sudden, you know, it's like this, that we're this intellectual elite as historians that we know things. It's Gnosticism. We know things that you don't know. And because you don't know them, you are not fit to be a part of our crowd. We've become insular. We've become almost, someone put it, the disciplines of history have become almost parochial in their sense that somehow or another they're set aside and above everything else. And because of that, people tend to look at it. You know, people don't go into the ministry like they used to. It used to be a very common vocation. People used to respect it. People used to want to go to it. People wanted to be priests, you know, or whatever. And that sort of faded away because it separated itself in such a way that it seemed unachievable. And I think we've kind of done that same thing to some degree with history. We've put it on this pedestal of you have to be, well, some kind of scholar to understand it. One of the things that I started Constitution Thursday for partly because I hate the phrase constitutional scholar. I do not believe that there is such thing as a constitutional scholar. I know, but Dave, professor, you're going to talk about Professor Amar next week, blah, blah, blah. I get that. I understand that there are professionals who have made the constitutional law their specialty, and I get that. The term constitutional scholar, however, sort of implies that there's some deep meaning here that is incomprehensible to anybody who doesn't study it for 25 hours a day, and therefore, if they don't know it the way we know it, well, they're doomed to repeat the mistakes. They're doomed to repeat the histories. That's why it's so important that you listen to us, because we have this internal knowledge that we have gained through so much of our study as scholars. And of course, the whole problem with that is the Constitution wasn't written for that purpose. It wasn't written to be read by scholars. It wasn't written to be understood on a metaphysical, almost Kabbalistic level. It was written for the common man to understand it. That scene in Star Trek, still one of my favorite scenes in the world. I know it's science fiction. I know it doesn't have anything to do with that. But James Kirk saying, this wasn't written for kings or the rich or the wealthy or princes or anything. This was written for everybody. You have slurred the meaning down through the years. And we've done that. We now have this attitude that the only people that can talk about the history of the Constitution are people that have scholarly degrees in the history of the Constitution. Baloney. Your great, 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 great grandparents sat around the bars in Boston and talked about it. Hell, their wives, they went home and their wives read it to them and said, I think you should vote for this way because this is involved in it. You know, people say, oh, it's a bunch of white misogynic slave owning guys. You might want to go read the actual history of it, but you won't because we're not constitutional scholars. And the constitutional scholars certainly aren't talking about the common man's history of the Constitution of the United States, are they? We're not talking about the common man's history of anything. We're not talking about the reasons why we need to know these things. There was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, folks, when presidential administrations had as staff members people who were professional historians. Art Schlesinger with Kennedy is a great example of this. Why did they have these people? Because these people had studied the humanities. They had studied history as humanities, as human beings, and they had studied the impacts of how things affected stuff and how things did what they did and why people do what they do and where they did it and what the results were and all those kinds of things. And they were able to advise presidents, you know, based in history. This is what I think. the common man's history, the common idea that somehow or another there is value in reviewing those things. I think of the story of Esther. You know, we've just come through Hanukkah, and we've just come through two attempts on one successful and one not successful attempts on synagogues and attacks. And I think back to Artaxerxes, the Book of Esther. And the Book of Esther is one of my, I mean, it really is one of, if I just had to pick a book that's my favorite in the Tanakh, it's probably Esther. Because it's a story that when you read it superficially, you go, okay, well, guy falls in love with girl, but there's so much more there. If you understand and you take the time to study the history of those people, but this idea that Artaxerxes one night can't sleep. And what does he read? What does he have read to him? He doesn't have read to him poetry. Oh, great king, your eyes are like stars. He doesn't have lyres singing to him. He doesn't have, you know, fictional stories about things. He has people read to him the history of his own administration, his own kingdom. On this date, you did this and this successful things. And in his brain, he's thinking back and he's learning those lessons from all of that. And it's that history then that causes him to realize that, oh, we never finished that. We should go back and finish that. And in the process, saves the Jews. It's an amazing story if you think about it. There are stories out there that I'm fascinated with because, you know, we've come through the 100th anniversary, the end of World War I. In my view, and I've said this on numerous of times, but in my view, the First World War was the most useless war ever. There was literally nothing accomplished. Nobody stood for, I know what Wilson said, the Arsenal for Democracy and all that, but reality is much different than political punditry. And if you've ever read Massey's book, Dreadnought, which I highly recommend. It's not an action book. You're not going to read about, you know, great leaders, and you are going to read about great leaders, but not in battle. It's a study. It's a historical study of politics and how a ship and its design led people to make the incredibly poor decisions that they made that resulted in 20 million people dying for literally nothing. I mean, nobody at the outset of World War I set out to say this war is to destroy monarchs. It's to tear down monarchical governments. Nobody thought that. That wasn't a plan of the war. That wasn't a war aim. It was simply an outcome of it. And all it really did was set the stage for even more destruction and more devastation downstream. But how many of us understand that? How many of us look at it now, you know, 100 years later, and look to ourselves and look to the decision-making processes that were used, and then open up our newspapers and go, hey, wait a minute. Because we don't. We think that everything that's happening now is the first time it's happened. We think that there's no precedent for things. I'm very proud of yesterday's Constitution Thursday. I thought we drew that in very well. That look, you know, Justice Thomas is right. The court should have heard this case because that's its job. And if we knew the history of that, we would understand that. I'm concerned that history is becoming... becoming such a scholarly discipline that there's no more common histories, there's no more general understandings. I love that Ben has a book, the Most Dangerous Book for Boys. I don't know if you've ever seen that or not, but it's a fascinating book, and he loves to read it. And there are history sections in there that talk about things that once upon a time were common knowledge that everybody knew and understood. The framers understood Roman history intensely. They understood Greek democracies intently. We don't. They studied all of the republics of Europe of their day. They understood all that stuff. We don't do that. And why don't we do that? Is it because we as historians have made history basically inaccessible? Because we've treated it like, well, if you don't know what I like, if you don't understand what I understand, if you don't learn from me, then, you know, you're just a... You know, you're just a Philistine culturally. Have we made it so that we are so, we are presenting history in such a way that somehow or another we become the focus of it. The teacher becomes the focus of it rather than the lessons, rather than the ideas. And look, folks, every bit of history that's out there, there isn't some deep historical lesson that must be applied to everything in every bit of history. And some of it is just as fascinating. Some of it is incredible. The Year of Five Emperors. I knew there was a Year of Five Emperors. I didn't really understand what had happened the other day until I was sitting in the dentist's office waiting for Ben reading about it going, holy crap, these people were nuts. But how do we convey that to the public going to people that should know that? How do we convey that to them and say, you know, this is important? I don't really know that it's necessary. It's important and applicable in the sense that you should be able to look at politicians and go, that's phony. That's just kabuki theater. What you're watching on television today in the last week is just nonsense. It's just crap. And it's the same crap that they've been pulling for 5,000 years. I was talking with Alex, the news guy, this morning about Seneca the Younger, and we were joking about a piece that he had done, and it's pretty funny. It was pretty apropos, but it tied into something. I mean, it was about a game, a modern game, but it tied into something that Seneca the Younger said 2,000 years ago. And at the same time that people might apply today, he also said something that's just absolutely fascinating. A well-controlled appetite is critical to liberty. Now you hear that and you go, it's just some old guy in history saying something, right? It's just some old guy that nobody even knows, that Seneca the Younger, Dave. Who the hell was that? A well-controlled appetite is critical to liberty, he said. And the same day that our governor announced that he wants $1.1 billion in new taxes to save the orcas. There's a connection there. Can we make that connection? Can we understand the importance of what's going on? And is it incumbent on us as historians then to make that connection less scholarly and more day-to-day life? And I think that that's what's happening with history. I think that the perception of history has become so intently scholarly that only historical majors, only doctors of history can teach us anything. And the framing generation would have laughed at that. They would have said, that's ridiculous. Abraham Lincoln would have laughed at that. Abraham Lincoln taught himself history by reading books by firelight at night. And we as historians have to figure out a way to get back to that. We have to figure out a way to make history meaningful in a populist manner again. All of it. We got to be willing to have those discussions about the ugly things in history. We got to be willing to talk about those things, not as victims and not as perpetrators, but as people who are trying to find meaning in them, because that's what the humanities do. And I sure hope that I can be a part of that. I hope over the next years, I certainly hope starting in January when we kick back off again, I hope that I can take that approach to it. And I hope that I have not taken the approach in the past of making this some sort of Gnostic, you know, special knowledge that if you don't have, you're lesser than I or lesser than someone else. I hope that you've never taken it that way from me, but I'm afraid that maybe it has. And in order to get past that, we historians are going to have to change. That's a fact. It's half past. It's the Dave Bowman Show. It's the final show of the year. Stay with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
What's up, Whitey?
Hey, Scotsman.
We're from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening
to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Radio Network. Dashing through the snow in a one horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. On bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride!
You are listening to The Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. This is Dave. It's the regular show finale for 2018. We will be here next week for Constitution Thursday, but the regular shows, this is it for the year. Holiday vacation start. You want to join me today? Area code 2. Wait, you want to join me any day? Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine. It's also the voicemail machine if you want to leave us voicemail. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show. We're on iTunes, also The Dave Bowman Show. And you can get us at thedavebowmanshow.com as well as podcast99.org. There are so many different ways to talk to us. Email Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. You got something to say to me, there's no reason not to say it. That's what I try to tell people. I'm not hiding. I was talking during the break to Alex, the news guy. See, that's why I love the 21st century. I really do. I love the 21st century. Because I can sit here in Silverdale, Washington, and during the break I can talk to Alex, my news guy, who's in Salisbury, Maryland. And, you know, I grew up in an era, speaking of history, I grew up in an era when long-distance phone calls were expensive. You didn't make long-distance phone calls because 10 cents a minute or 20 cents a minute or so. I don't even remember how much they were. But I remember that they were very expensive. And so I remember my parents, when we would call my grandparents down in Oklahoma City, we were growing up in Denver, and we would write down, we'd have to write down like on a 3x5 index card, the things that we wanted to tell grandpa and grandma. It was, you know, because you had to get to it and get right through it because boy, it was expensive. And, you know, it's, and now I sit here during the break and Alex and I are talking about the books that the Dreadnought book, which again, I highly recommend, but it's a political book. It's not an action book. You're not going to, there's nothing thrilling about it. The follow-up book to it, Castles of Steel, is fantastic, but Dreadnought is an important book, and it's such an important book that people have used it now since it came out as a textbook in studying of human history and political history, which, of course, is dying. And I wonder sometimes if the reason it's dying is because of books like Dreadnought, which, you know, people buy a book, they spend $20 on a hardcover book at Barnes & Noble or wherever. How about this? Walden's Books. And they expect, that's where I bought mine. God, 30 years ago, it seems like. But we expect some, you know, romance and action and all that. And what we get are a bunch of old guys that have pithy sayings and arguments about things that we think don't matter anymore. But they still do. And we got to figure out a way to communicate that. And I'm hoping as we kind of reevaluate some things here, like I said, I thought yesterday's show did a good job of that. I thought we took a subject from the day and we went back and looked at, you know, how it was designed to be and why it was designed to be that way without being, you know, brain pan upside the head with skillet going, psh, follow along, psh, learn this lesson, psh, or you're stupid. Psh, I am a genius. Listen to me. I hope it didn't come across that way. And I hope in the future it doesn't as well, because really understanding the past shouldn't be that way. And we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens in the whole thing. There are some things that are happening in the world today. Governor Inslee, as our state governor up here, has announced his new budget proposals for next year, which, you know, for years, I lived in California for 20 years and I was always fascinated by the budget process there, which was, you know, we're going to pretend we're going to get this much revenue. And then when we don't get that much revenue, we're going to trigger some cuts, the famous trigger cuts. It was. And then with the passing of the ballot props that changed how we did budgeting. So now it was just basically, not my words, somebody else's, a ham sandwich in a wrapper. It could be passed as the budget and literally was at times. And they have some weird things down in California about trailer bills and gut amend and stuff like that. That's pretty entertaining if you're into California politics. Up here, it's not quite as entertaining, but it is interesting. The governor comes out with his, it's essentially, because it comes out in December, it's essentially a wish list. Here's what I'd like. And it's like, I want 30 million for this. I want, you know, a billion for that. I want new taxes on this. I want that. The thing is, here in Washington, we don't have an income tax. And so there's always attempts by the government to introduce new taxes that are actually income taxes, but they call them something else. And then it's just a matter of how long does it take before people realize that it's actually an income tax and start screaming and yelling. And then that's always entertaining. And of course he has that in this year's budget. I was intrigued by two things in this budget though. I guess the entire country has this, and we really haven't spent as much time on this as we can, and obviously we're not going to get to this year, but the mental health crisis in our country is apparently, and by all accounts, at a critical stage. There are more mentally ill people than ever. Now, that could be because we've redefined and expanded what is mentally ill. It could be. There's arguments on both sides of the equation, but it's clear that we are not dealing with the mental ill crisis in an effective and meaningful way. Most people in government see that meaningful and effective as meaning is to be interpreted as spending more money on it. That's always the solution. Let's just spend more money on it. So the state of Washington, we have an interesting system for this. We have the Western State Hospital and the Eastern State Hospital. The Western State Hospital is actually in Tacoma. And oddly enough, it's like literally a mile from where my brother-in-law lives. It's a building that was built when Fort Steilacoom was built back in the 1860s. I mean, it's an imposing castle, old castle-like building. It's a little unnerving when you drive by it. And it has this stone wall that was built by the patients over the years, and it's a little creepy. It really is. And over the last few months, they've had several incidents there, including one recently where a nurse was attacked by one of the patients and bitten quite viciously. And so this has drawn attention to the mental illness situation that we have here in the state of Washington. And this has led the governor to focus in his budget on one of his list things as more money for mental illness. Now, I think you would find most people would say, well, that's probably something that we should be doing. It's probably something that, you know, as a function of government, not only does it protect the public, which every politician will tell you is their most important job, and at the same time, it helps those folks who are perhaps not getting the treatment that they need. And of course, there's all arguments about that. So he has asked for $30 million to improve mental health services in Washington state. And like I said, I don't think you're going to find a whole lot of people that are going to argue about that. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where I think they could be doing dumber things with that money. They could, it's typical government. They would be wasting it elsewhere. So maybe that's a good use of that money that the state of Washington has. The other thing that he's concerned about are the 74 resident orca whales. We have 74 what they call southern resident orcas. These are orcas that actually live in Puget Sound. Many orcas actually live out in the ocean, and they come into the Puget Sound on a cycle basis to get food and whatever. But these particular 74 actually live here. They actually reside in the southern Puget Sound, Seattle, Tacoma. Last year, they were actually over here in Silverdale. They came up to Dyes Inlet, and they were dancing around out there, and they're cool to watch. There's 74 of them, and of course, they're endangered because orcas are endangered, and these particular whales have seen a reduction in their numbers through the years. And I mean, we were talking about it in the summertime. One of the calves was sick, and geez Louise, you'd have thought it was, you'd have thought that was the only news in the world up here. Every nightly news, every morning news started with an update on J50 and her condition and what was going on. And so the governor has looked at this and said, well, it's important that we do something for these 74 resident orca whales. And again, I don't disagree with the concept that we should do something. I like orcas. I think they're pretty cool. I think they're fun to watch. And they certainly, I mean, orcas, Ben and I read the book the other night, The Orca versus the Great White Shark. He has a bunch of these such and such versus such and such, like Velociraptor versus T-Rex, polar bear versus grizzly bear, you know, who would win, and they're, who would win, I guess is the name of the title. And he has one, orca versus great white shark. Now, orcas, as it turns out, I don't know if you knew this or not, the orcas are like the top of the food chain in the ocean. You might have thought it was the sharks, but it's not. It's the orcas. The orcas, the National Geographic had a whole thing about orcas apparently kill great white sharks basically for fun. It's weird, but it's true. Orcas, as it turns out, are kind of the jerks of the ocean. I mean, they're at the top of the feed chain and they know it. And they sometimes they'll kill a great white shark and just eat its liver and leave the rest. Anyway, the orcas are fascinating creatures. They really are. And so the governor has said, well, we need to do something to help save these 74 resident orca whales. You know, the rest of them, screw them, but 74, that we got to do something for. And so he has proposed, through a system of new taxes and raising the business and occupation tax here in Washington, and that to raise $1.1 billion to help save the resident orca whales. Now, again, if you listen to him explain it to you, if you listen to him talk about it, he'll tell you that this is everybody pulling on the same rope. This is everybody working together to save the resident orca whales and all that. And but I'm questioning something here. It's not unlike when they started doing tickets for texting while driving. Remember this? If you're texting while driving, we will catch you and we will write you a ticket. And the ticket will be, I think it was $150 or something for the first offense. And I scoffed at it. I remember hanging around with a lot of cops back then on the shows, on the Saturday morning show I was producing. I said, this isn't about safety. This is about revenue enhancement. That's all it is. You're just hoping that people will continue to text so that you can write them a $150 ticket. And that's all this is. No, Dave, it's about safety. Really? Okay, if it's really about safety, why is it $150 to text while driving, but $1,000 to park in a handicap spot? See, one of those, they don't really want you to do. They don't want you to park in a handicap spot, so we'll make that fine, $1,000. Boom. And oddly enough, very few people would illegally park in handicap spots. But oddly enough, people kept texting while driving because, number one, you probably weren't going to get caught. Number two, the fine wasn't really sufficient to deter it. It really wasn't about safety. It was about, you know, appearance. It was about looking like we cared about safety. The same thing is true here. We care about the orcas. We're going to spend $1.1 billion in Washington state tax money to, quote unquote, save the orca whales. With no guarantee, by the way, that anything we do with this $1.1 billion will actually save anything. We have a scientific consensus, they say, but reality is, what does that mean? Scientific consensus to what? That the orca whales need more food? And so part of this $1.1 billion, I'm not making this up, is going to be spent, quote, culling seals, unquote. So we're going to feed the orcas dead seals, but we can't feed chipmunks up on Trail Ridge because that will create a dependent society. I'm just thinking out loud here. That's all I'm doing. So we're going to spend this $1.1 billion on the orca whales. And while at the same time acknowledging the fact that we have this mental health crisis, this mental health human disaster that if we don't fix, it's going to be, you know, just the sky is going to fall. We only want $30 million for that. Do you see my problem with this? Do you see why I kind of go, really? Is that really? I mean, it's all about, you know, it's all about appearances. It's all about making it look like we care about something. And the bigger the number you put on it, the bigger the number the people think you care. Orcas, $1.1 billion. We care. Mentally ill people, $30 million. We care. But only 3% as much as we care about the orcas. But nobody's smart enough to figure it out. Nobody's out. No, I haven't seen anybody on the news go, well, wait a minute. What if we really cared about this? Then would we really do it that way? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with the governor's budget. Again, it's just a wish list. It's just a Christmas wish list. And again, it has to get through the state legislature and has to be approved by people who are going to suck up to the public for votes because, you know, they're gonna want to keep their phony baloney jobs too. And at the end of the day, and the other thing about this is Governor Inslee is running for president in 2020. That's well known around here. I don't know if you know that where you are, but Jay Inslee of Washington is running for governor or running for president in 2020. And so he wants to make it look like he cares. So there you go. That's our budget. That's our proposal. $1.1 billion for whales. $30 million. For mental illness. I don't know where it's going to end up. I got no idea. What I do know is it was this date in 1972 that we as human beings did something for the last time. I'm afraid that it's going to be the last time ever. I have this eternal optimism in my heart that we are going to go back to the moon. That human beings will one day colonize the moon. But I also understand that there's a lot of technical issues with it, that it's not as simple as landing a rocket on the moon, building a dome and going, well, we're here. Or on Mars, we're here. It's not that simple. There are numerous technical challenges to be overcome, but I also know that technical challenges are what human beings love to overcome. I know that for a fact. And I know that it was this day in 1972 that Gene Cernan wrote his daughter's initials in the moon dust there and climbed up into the lunar module. And for the final time ever, mankind stood on and then left the moon. There's a fascinating sequence, obviously, of a video that you see where they are actually inside the lunar module there. They're in the ascent stage. And this is actually being filmed from the lunar rover, which was left behind. And the guy that's controlling this is on Earth, and he has to anticipate that 2.5 second delay in the signals. And they tried it before on 15 and 16. It didn't work very well. But on 17, you can see the thrust there, and you can see that thing leaving. And you can see the ascent stage with Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt leaving the moon. I could watch that a million times and never get tired of it. I really don't. I really don't get tired of watching that sequence. I love how they treated it in From the Earth to the Moon, Tom Hanks's special. Maybe that's how we should be teaching history. I don't know. That's one of those shows that you learn, but you don't even realize you're learning from. And when you watch that one for Apollo 17, it's just you get history from the turn of the century France all the way to 1972, when they lifted off of that platform on the moon for the final time. I hope it's not the last time we go, but I just feel like somehow or another we've convinced ourselves that we don't need to go no more. We don't need to do any of that anymore. I hope not, but I guess we'll have to wait and see where it all ends up, won't we? That's the beauty of understanding the past, is that you can look forward to the future. You don't have to be guided by this. Well, if it failed once, it's doomed to failure if you don't learn from it. Well, if you don't remember it. Well, I understand the sentiment, but I don't agree with the idea. Just because we failed once doesn't mean we shouldn't try again. My son says it. You're either succeeding or you're learning. And that's the lesson that we should learn from history. Well, it's been a great year, everybody. I didn't get to the Ted Lieu story, sorry, but it's been a great year. We've had a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to a couple of weeks off here and then coming back on January the 2nd to hit it again. And hopefully I can apply the lessons that I've taken from this, that history has to be done not like I'm hitting you over the head with it. Hopefully I can take that to heart and learn from that as well. And we will continue with this starting in January 2nd. We should be back after the new year. Quick thanks to a couple of people that have been a big part of this. Alex Ross. Alex does the news for us, and he just does it, and a lot of other things. He does just a great job. And so I appreciate you, Alex. You have been a real blessing and a real joy to work with in all of this. Tim Preuss is on hiatus at the moment, but it's fun talking to Tim, and he actually gives me a lot of chances to talk about things that are interesting. And thanks to all of you who listen and watch and join in and comment and text and email and yell at me and all that stuff. It's great. I love it. So let's keep that up in the new year as well. All right. I got to get running. Got a lot to do today, as usual. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show. For the final time this year, except for Constitution Thursday next week. We'll see you on Monday, January 2nd at 10 a.m. Pacific. And in the meantime, everybody, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Dave Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.